podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Buzz Podcast, broadcasting to you from a very windy rural Ireland. I'm Trev Downey and I'm joined, of course, by Dave Hendrick, who's equally rural and also subject to the wind. We're hoping that this storm-like condition won't impede our progress as we move on to Al Pacino Part 3, if you can believe it. And we have every hope this will be the final part as we deal with the years from 2000 to the present. That may seem a little bit ambitious, Dave, but we're going to try it, damn it. And the two shows before this, I think it's understandable, really, because the early days are full of some of the great classics and great stories that you want to get down on Al and the evolution of his career. And then the 90s is this kind of renaissance that required a show all to itself. It was a bit of a powerhouse decade for him, including a film which is going to be the focus of our second podcast this week, Glengarry Glen Ross. This is a different era, a more sort of, I think, laid back, not the focus of all the movies starring role kind of era, and yet very, very busy. I mean, the guy is working endlessly. It's It's quite remarkable to look at the output from 2000 onwards. You would think this guy would slow down, but he's not doing that at all.
No, him and Bob De Niro both seem to have decided that their twilight years were not to be spent with family or with their partners or doing, you know, any hobbies or anything, but just to work endlessly and perhaps make as much money as possible. There's some really good films that Al has done since 2000. Like you said, he's not the lead in all of them. There are a few regrettable ones that I wonder if he was given the opportunity to scrub them from history, would he consider it? But yeah, I think we will get through the rest in one part, because unlike the 70s, 80s, unlike the 90s, there's not a huge amount here that we really need to dig into too deep. There's a few that we'll be able to skip over. There might be one or two that we laugh at. But yeah, I mean, it's a different era of Al Pacino.
Yeah, and I think, whereas in the 90s, I think we both mentioned it, it was, oh, another Al Pacino event, because he was very much front and center. And we finished our chat the last day looking at, you know, two absolute belters in Any Given Sunday and The Insider, in which you have now. And we did say, and it, I've been thinking a lot about it. This is, again, one of our many tangents here. I promise it won't get derailed here, but I've been thinking a lot. We need to do a Russell Crowe episode. We really, really do. That guy is... He's such a powerhouse of acting. He's got such a body of work. And in The Insider, as you were saying and I was saying, it's very much a shared top billing. But nonetheless, Al's there Any Given Sunday. Again, he's surrounded by a very strong ensemble cast, but it's him, you know, City Hall, it's him, Heat, it's him and Bob De Niro, but it's still him. Carlito's Way, it's him. Scent of a Woman, it's him. Glengarry Glen Ross, even though it's the ultimate ensemble, he's kind of the star turn still. Godfather Part 3 and Frankie and Johnny, again, shared top billing in Frankie and Johnny, but still it's Al. Al's the focus. He is the big star. He is big man on campus in all of those movies. And then it starts to change a little bit. And it's interesting to see that happen. You don't really expect it. It's quite sudden to go from 1999 to the run of movies that happens afterwards. And I'm just curious to see what you make of this run of movies that happens afterwards. If we start with 2000, there's one that I didn't see, and it was, I think, a movie that cost Al a little bit in terms of I think his own personal finances, Chinese Coffee. An independent American movie. It stars him and Jerry Orbach, who people will be familiar with when they see him, but maybe not the name. And, you know, I think it's written by a guy called Ira Lewis, and Al takes on directorial duties himself. You know, it's coming from a play. We know Al's passion for the theater, and he probably thought, okay, this is something I can turn into a successful film version. Now, The one that we're going to talk about next, Glengarry Glen Ross, is a wonderful example of how you can turn a film, turn a play into a film successfully. There aren't a huge amount of those. Mm. And I don't, you would imagine the low-key nature of this, the comparatively small level of exposure and success of this would suggest that it's possibly one of those was more of a passion project than anything else.
Oh, without question. Yeah, without question, this was very much a passion project. The thing is, like, it doesn't really work as a film. Like, there's a good performance from Al. There's a good performance from Jerry Orbach. For those that don't, the Jerry Orbach name doesn't spark anything. He's Lenny Briscoe in Law and Order for 20 years or 10 years or however long it was. That's what he's best known for. So people would probably remember him from that. But yeah, I mean, I'd imagine it was excellent as a play. I haven't seen it on stage, but I just don't think it worked as a film.
Now, in the immediate aftermath of that, there's a period of 2 years before we come to a year where he actually churns out quite a bit of stuff. You've got Insomnia, you've got Simone, and you've got People I Know. And I will openly admit to not, and this is, again, what I like about these things and doing these things is that I'm putting together a little bit of a list of gaps in my knowledge that I need to go back and fill in. One of those is People I Know, which he stars alongside Kim Basinger, Ryan O'Neill, and Tia Leone. So, I mean, it's a solid cast. And Daniel Algrant, a director I'm not familiar with. So I don't really know anything about this one. The other two I'm in a position to comment on. And we'll take these as a bundle. Insomnia, I know you found a little bit, I think you were saying that you found it a little bit tedious. Certainly the pacing of it is lends itself to that. It's a Chris Nolan movie. We've already done an entire show on him. It's a strong cast with him and Robin Williams and Hilary Swank. And it's very atmospheric. We talked before about how it was sort of Nolan's chance at working with big budget and big stars and his breakthrough kind of in that regard, and how he's very proud of it. And he made a point of saying that people have said to him afterwards, you know, that they liked that movie. I don't know whether he was making that point because it's like, well, don't let that get lost in the morass of ridiculous success I've had elsewhere. But I have to say, I've enjoyed this movie the few times I've watched it, but I totally get what you're saying about the pacing. Some films, it really does depend on how you are going into it. And if you're, I'm inclined as I get older, since the age of 30, I noticed I could sleep anywhere. And so I totally get that. It's quite ironic that the movie's called Insomnia and focuses on a lad called Will Dormer who suffers with that condition. I think it's an absolutely glorious performance by him, by Robin Williams as well, that makes the movie worth watching, if for no other reason.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, like I've had that issue for a long time, that just a weird ability to sleep, even when I don't necessarily want to sleep. The cinema, buses, trains, aeroplanes, wherever I am that I'm sitting for a long time, I'm probably going to fall asleep. So it might be a thing. I think I do owe this film a rewatch for certain. There's parts of it that I do like, and I agree with you fully that the performances, particularly Al and Robin Williams, were really, really strong. And like at this point, Hilary Swank was sort of, everything she touches turns to gold as well. So I do want to rewatch it, but yeah, I've had a mixed relationship with it so far.
What I like about it is it sort of sets the tone for the best part of the time to come, the best part of what we're going to speak about between now and the end of this show, which is strong, almost supporting role from Al. Obviously, like, you know, he's kind of high in the billing here and he gets a lot of camera time, but it's sort of starting to set the tone for, you know, the movies like, you know, where he's it's a smaller role, and yet, you know, he's kind of the usual magnetic Pacino that you want to watch and you're very, very fascinated by. Now, Simone is another interesting one that I saw once. And when I saw that it, you know, you first of all, I saw, okay, it's Andrew Niccol, and I really like Gattaca that he did. And I was thinking, okay, it's got Al, it's got Catherine Keener, who's just wonderful, and in an awful lot of American independent cinema as well as mainstream stuff. Evan Rachel Wood, Rachel Roberts, Jay Moore, who can be hit and miss, in my opinion, and Winona Ryder, who's usually very good. So I'm thinking, okay, this is going to be very interesting. Can't wait to see what this is. I'm not 100% sure if it's a great movie. I just thought it was fine when I watched it. There was aspects to it that I was interested in. I can see why Niccol might have been attracted to the script, but he didn't work the same magic for me as he did with Gattaca. It didn't have that sort of memorability for me, and there were parts of it that I thought were a bit daft. Well, I'm curious to hear your take on this, and if you have seen People I Know.
Yeah, I have seen People I Know. On Simone, it just kind of left me cold. It didn't really do anything for me. It's not a bad film. There's, you know, there's a decent story in there. I like you, I can see why Andrew Niccol decided to take it on. I think in retrospect, he'd probably do it slightly differently. It's, again, with Pacino, it's a decent performance. It's certainly not one of his standout performances, but like, it's not a bad film at all. It's just not a particularly great film. You know, it's just okay. If it was on, I'd watch it, but I wouldn't go out of my way to watch it, you know?
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
That's
kind of
what, like, if I flicked over and it was on, I'd be like, oh, well, I'll watch this, but I wouldn't go looking for it or anything like that. I certainly wouldn't expend any energy trying to find it. As for People I Know, again, it's a little bit of a by the numbers kind of film. Like, there's a very good cast, very, very good cast in it. It's clearly well directed, but again, it's not one that you should seek out. Like, if you're just trying to make sure you've ticked off all the Al boxes, sure.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's one you'd go back and rewatch. You know, it's not one I think you'd add to a list of films that you might put into a cycle to rewatch every couple of years. It's not strong enough for that.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's interesting to. I think that is very much in keeping with the era we're talking about now. Because if you look at the next year after that, the absolute perfect example of what I was talking about is The Recruit. Because The Recruit obviously features Al Pacino, but it's sort of building on the rising star that is Colin Farrell. He's front and center as this next shiny Hollywood thing. And Al's in this kind of supporting role, the kind of wise old, canny old, is he trustworthy, is he not trustworthy, spook kind of figure. And I think it suits him perfectly. You know, the crumpled older version of Al, perfect. Suits him absolutely down.
Plenty of big Al.
Plenty of big Al, and, you know, he's performing to his audience of recruits on an awful lot of, in an awful lot of the movie, or he's having these kind of tense interactions with the X or Y character. I I'll be honest with you. This type of movie, I'm a sucker for this type of movie, because we spoke a little bit about this before when we were both, I think, quite vehemently defending the 2005 Miami Vice, Michael Mann's one with Colin Farrell and Jamie Foxx. If a thing kind of looks cool or has an element of cool or has people in it that I like, I'm going to be well disposed towards it. And I could just watch this nonsense. I've probably seen The Recruit about 5 or 6 times, I'll be honest with you. If it's on, I will watch it. That's the kind of movie that I think this is. The other one that came out in 2003 is a different thing altogether.
Yes,
now listen, there's a fantastic director in terms of one of the best movies by Bobby De Niro I've ever seen is Midnight Run, and Martin Brest directed that. I love that film. It's a real one-off, real kind of unusual, hits all sorts of unusual notes. Love it. So obviously
he also directed Scent of a Woman as well, didn't he?
He did. So we that established there, that's very good. Ben Affleck's a good actor. Jennifer Lopez is a good actor. Justin Bartha, pretty good actor. But I don't know what I make of this film at all, because to me, it just didn't really hang properly. It's not as cringy as some people would have you believe. It's not just as awful as some people would have you believe. It got a big kicking. It was dubbed as one of the worst films of all time. But I sometimes think people see people getting to a certain level, whether it was Affleck or Jennifer Lopez, and they go, right, it's time for your kicking now. Mm. So I don't know if it's literally, I've seen many, many worse films than this, but it's not good. Let's be honest. No. And you know, it's, you've got Christopher Walken in there as well. I mean, tell me a little bit about, first of all, your take on The Recruit, and then Al as Starkman in Jiggly.
Yeah, I love The Recruit as well. Like you, I'll watch that film. I'll actually, that's one I will go out my way to watch.
Mm.
Because like you said, it's that version of Al that he settled into in the 90s with the crumpled suit, and he just looks like he hasn't slept in a week. And if he did sleep last, it was, you know, upside down behind a bar, and he's bleary eyed and he's roaring at everybody, and there's lots of gesticulation and explosive moments, and I love it. So, and like you said, like Colin Farrell at this point really was one on the rise. You've got Bridget Moynihan in there with a strong performance as well, a really good director on that one in Roger Donaldson, who'd done some absolutely belting films. His first one, Sleeping Dogs, is excellent. He'd done Cocktail, he did Cadillac Man, he did Dante's Peak, he did 13 Days. Like, he'd done a lot of good films, and I do think that's another good film, and I would watch that pretty repeatedly. Jiggly, on the other hand, no. As your brother said when asked to direct Fatal Deviation 2, I know. wouldn't be for me now. Again, it's somewhere between not good and the worst film ever, but it's certainly not the worst film ever. There are, like you said, there are many worse films than this, but you're right. It was the time probably for J-Lo, who, like, she'd had that meteoric rise in the 90s. Was seen as kind of the golden girl of, you know, across the different spheres of music and film and fashion, and everything she did was just a 1,000,000% hit.
Do you remember her in U-Turn?
Yes.
Because I that sort of burned into my head, that sort of orangey dress and her up putting up curtains or something. It's like, yeah, I'll probably watch that all day. And like, to be fair, she does have that part, that sort of presence, and holds her own against sort of like potential charisma, you know, vacuums, as in sucking it all into them, like Clooney. She can do that, you know, out of sight. She's really good in that as well. I think it might be that, you know, both herself and Affleck, and the fact that they were a couple, it was like, yeah, time to kick these down a bit, you know.
See, but that's what it was. I think that's what it was. The fact that they were a couple at the time, and they were the golden couple. Now, she had done Made in Manhattan the year before, which had been panned as well. And I think that was the first kind of knock to her kind of reputation. Because if you look back, like, she did Money Train with Wesley Snipes and Woody Harrelson, and I love that film. Like, I White Men Can't Jump is one of my favorite films. So when those two got put back together for that, I loved it. No matter who was in it, I was going to love it. But like you said, like Out of Sight, U-Turn, she'd done The Cell is pretty good. She'd done some decent stuff and was very much on the up. But Made in Manhattan kind of knocked the reputation. And I think the relationship with Affleck, and the fact that these two were seen as like the golden couple and like the real power couple now, and he likewise had kind of done a string of hits, and he couldn't have been at that point any kind of hotter in terms of Hollywood pull than he was at the time. And then they do this. And again, like, as you mentioned, it's Al Pacino, Christopher Walken. Like, it's a really good cast. It's a good director. I think people just wanted it to fail. It was almost like there's too many people in this film who've had it too good. So let's just kill them. It's not good. So let's just make it seem much worse than it actually is. And of course, this, over the years, there's been a couple of very, very powerful film critics like Roger Ebert, Richard Roper. Both of them hammered this film. And as soon as they did that, public perception was one way. This is awful. Nobody should go and watch it. It's dreadful. It's the worst film you'll ever see. Don't bother. And it did. It killed this film before it ever really got the chance to get going. But I think Owen Gleiberman of Entertainment Weekly, I think he nails it with his review. A watchable bad movie, but it's far from your typical cookie-cutter blockbuster. There are no shootouts or car crash, and there isn't much romantic suspense either. I think he's right. This film is hard to pigeonhole as to what it is, and I think that confuses a lot of people. But it is. It's a watchable bad movie. Like, if it was on, it's not going to be the worst 2 hours of your life to watch this film. No, I can get a laugh out of it.
That, I think, is going to be a sort of a, if not that exact refrain, but something along those lines for an awful lot of what we're going to talk about over the next few minutes. Thankfully, we do have a pause in that, though, because in 2004 is The Merchant of Venice, which is directed by Michael Radford. And it's a movie I've seen a lot because I use it as a study aid when in my work. So it is something I've seen at least chunks of. I don't tend to be, I'm not one of those people who would stick on a DVD and sort of coast for the class. But I do like to use certain scenes. And, you know, there are certain incredibly memorable scenes in Merchant of Venice, the whole, if you prick us, do we not bleed scene, where it's basically Shylock explaining how the treatment of Jewish people is by Christians is absolutely horrendous and lacking in any parity. And so it's a very, very interesting play. And Shylock is a very interesting character. Are we supposed to, I guess, have sympathy for a guy who's clearly as materialistic as he is, who clearly values his possessions and wealth over the people in his life? Can we sympathize with him because he is actually on the side of the law and that he is actually getting played by people who really have bad and ill intent toward him? It's a really interesting situation to put an actor into, and I think he revels in this. I think he's absolutely magnificent as Shylock. And whatever the sort of, you know, what Russell Crowe was talking about, how in Gladiator himself and Ollie Reed got together and they were talking about, like, how are we going to do this? Like, what? And basically they decided everyone was going to speak with British accents because just the simplest thing to do. And Russell Crowe described the version of English that he was speaking as pissed rada. And I think there's a little element of that with Al. Whatever Al's doing here, it's sort of a neutral accent. He is consistent with it. There's no New Yorkisms coming through.
No.
There's no traditional googly eye Big Al either.
I think it's a great film, genuinely.
Yeah.
Like, I really enjoy this film. I've seen probably 6 or 7 times.
Yeah.
It's so, like, the cast is unbelievable as well.
Yeah, it is.
Like, Jeremy Irons, Joseph Fiennes, Lynn Collins, I'd watch her in anything.
Yeah.
Like, Chris Marshall, Mackenzie Crook, who's very, very underrated as an actor because he's done, you know, The Office and he did the Pirates of the Caribbean and stuff, but he's very underrated in terms of his range. It's a great, great cast.
You've seen Detectorists, haven't you? You've seen Detectorists?
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
Like, I mean, what a joy that show is. I did not see that coming. I just said, I'll watch an episode of it. It's him and the madness that is Toby. And I just thought, this is either going to be awful or and it was The Hour. It's just a gorgeous show. And the two of them are no perfect. It's the best weird friendship you're ever going to see on TV. Love it. And yeah, I had it. I came away with a real respect for Mackenzie Crook as an actor after that. So yeah, I mean, it is. It's incredibly strong all the way through. And people like who can do little jobs like Chris Marshall. Some people really like him as a comedy actor, and you know, there Charlie Cox is in it, for God's sake, in a really minor role as Lorenzo. And you know, we could do a show on some of the things that he's done, from Irish to American to English. I'll tell you what, Charlie Cox can do an accent, give him that.
Yeah,
right. But there is no two ways about it. Despite all of this tremendous support, despite it looking gorgeous and being beautifully filmed, despite this really strong direction, or maybe because of it, Pacino's just absolutely incredible. It's absolutely his performance of the decade for me.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would agree. I actually would say it's not even a close run thing, I don't think. There's some, and he has some really good performances in this decade, but this for me would stand well above. Like, if you're putting together a top 15 of Al films, I think this is comfortably in that top 15.
And now we're getting into a run of movies where I don't know what to say about any of them except they're fine. And if they were on the television, I'd watch them. So in 2005, there's Two for the Money, where he stars alongside Matt McConaughey and Rene Russo and Armand Assante. And that's okay. That's a nice little gathering. I think it's DJ Caruso directing. 88 Minutes is the next one. John Avnet, who people might know. But again, the cast, Alicia Witt, Lily Sobieski, people know her face if they don't know the name. William Forsythe, Deborah Kara Unger, who was in The Game, if people don't know who that is. Amy Brenneman, who's worked with Bobby De Niro on Heat and him. Neil McDonough. And again, if it's on, I'll watch it. Yeah. Next one up then that's worth mentioning is Ocean's 13. And this is the one that I'm going to pause on because this is 2007, by the way. 05 was Two for the Money, and then two movies, 88 Minutes and Ocean's 13 in 2007. And I just think that, again, this is one of those ones where surrounded by all of these huge names, including his ex-co-star, Ellen Barkin, and his ex-co-star, Andy Garcia, and people like Clooney and Pitt and Matt Damon and all the rest of it, I just think he absolutely steals the show in this role. I think he's brilliant, and I think he elevates the movie by having a credible bad guy. I think it just makes all the difference to that film.
I really enjoyed that film, really, really enjoyed it. Now I like 11 and 12 as well, but I really enjoyed this one. And you're right, I think Al steals the show here. And what's hilarious is when you look at the theatrical release poster, Al is in a little box in the corner. He's not part of the main cast picture. That's how deep a support role he has here. But he manages to elevate himself above. Good performances by Clooney and Damon and Don Cheadle, who I always liked, and Bernie Mac, who was tremendous. It's just a really, really good performance from Al in what I think is a good film, a very watchable film. I think you'd have great crack just sticking on that trilogy and watching them back to back to back. And this was like, as you said, you know, Two for the Money is a film I do like. I think McConaughey's very, very good in it. And it's an interesting premise that is very American in that sort of sports tipping type of thing.
Yeah.
And then obviously the gangster element. I think it's a good film. 88 Minutes is, again, it's a solid film. It's not great. It's not one you're going to watch endlessly, but if it's on, it's worth a watch. But yeah, this for me, because this is, in terms of his career to date, this is the first time he's not just kind of the second banana. He's the fourth or fifth banana in this. And it's probably the first time in his entire career he's been in this type of role. And he's excellent.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. I was just clicked on it to see the poster there as you're talking. And it's just the Sea of Love cast in the corner. Don't mind us. You know what I mean? Tremendous stuff. I do love the next little sequence that we've got going on here, because I'm curious to see what you make of it. It's an interesting run. If we take 2008, and I think we should run up as far as maybe 2012. So there's going to be four movies here. 08 sees his second John Avnet film in 3 years. I think I'm right in saying 2 years. 88 Minutes was 07, and Righteous Kill is 08. Now, Righteous Kill is memorable for the reuniting of Pacino and De Niro. That in and of itself is a story. They're playing cops, and it's cops and serial killers. What's not to like, right? Theoretically, that's that. The next one up is a movie called The Son of No One, and it is, again, a very interesting cast. Tracy Morgan's in it, Katie Holmes, Ray Liotta, Juliette Binoche. And again, it's based on a book. Whether or not it's a success, I'm not 100% sure. Channing Tatum's in it as well, I think. Obviously, I think he might be the main character in it. And then the next one up is 2011's Jack and Jill. This is Adam Sandler. It's an Adam Sandler comedy. And I think it's got Katie Holmes in there as well as Al in a smaller role. And then there's Stand Up Guys in 2012, which is directed by Fisher Stevens, who most people will know better as an actor. He's been in a lot of stuff. I think most recently, in terms of big movies, he was in Asteroid City. He was in Motherless Brooklyn, which is a freaking wonderful film that not many people have seen. Absolutely brilliant. One of the best performances of Ed. Oh my God, I'm having a blank here. Oh my God. Ed Norton. One of Ed Norton's best performances. Absolutely tremendous film. But Fisher Stevens is in that. He's also in Hail Caesar. People remember him from Grand Budapest Hotel. You'll know his face when you see it, but he directs this movie called Stand Up Guys in 2012. And it has, get this, Al Pacino, Chris Walken, Alan Arkin. I mean, how can you make a thing like that not work? And, you know, an awful lot, you do see this. You do see when actors, especially sort of guys who do bit part roles and are just character actors and well-connected, and they reach out quite often, they can get these stellar casts of lads who work with them as a favor as much as anything else. So, I mean, I could not wait to see this. I could not wait to see Righteous Kill. I was quite anxious to see what Al would do in The Son of No One and Jack and Jill. And I come away from all of them with this sort of amorphous blob in my head of nothing particularly memorable. The two, if you had to pick out the two that I remember the most, it's Righteous Kill and Stand Up Guys. And only, I think, because the lads sort of bouncing off each other on the screen in both films. But again, I don't think there's a tremendous movie in the bunch.
No, there isn't. Look, the problem for Righteous Kill was that when it was announced, it was never, ever going to live up to the hype, because this was the first time the two boys were back together from Heat. And I think people were expecting Heat 2, really and truly. They were expecting that caliber of movie. This doesn't have the cast for that. It doesn't have the director for that. And most importantly, it doesn't have the story for that. There's a bit too much Curtis 50 Cent Jackson for my taste. I wouldn't particularly class him as a good actor.
Yeah.
But look, like Donnie Wahlberg is solid, and Carla Gugino is solid, and you know it's solid. But there's nobody that you're looking at and going, like, when Al or De Niro aren't on the screen, they're going to be able to really carry this. And the two boys give kind of by-the-numbers performances.
That's it, isn't it? You know? That's it. And that's how I felt a little bit, I'll be honest with you, about The Irishman too, even though there was some lovely stuff in it. I don't want to anticipate that because we're coming to it, but I don't know, maybe I had just the expectations I have had weren't matched by what I actually saw on the screen. I don't know if that's them or if that's the director or what it is, but yeah, anyway.
I think it was everything. With this, I think it was the whole production. The Son of No One is okay. Again, it's, you know, it's a decent cop movie. It's not a waste of your time to watch it, but, you know, Jack and Jill, I mean, for me, like, Sandler had that incredible run where, you know, he just made gold after gold after gold from Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore, The Waterboy, Big Daddy, Juice Bigelow, Little Nicky. Like, these were all really good films. Mr. Deeds is probably the last one of his that I would look at and say, that's a must watch. Like, he's done some decent stuff since, like The Longest Yard, I think is a good watch. It's not as good as the original, but it's a good watch. He's done a few recently where, even a couple where it's been more serious roles, like Uncut Gems. But he went through this phase where it really did seem like it was just money grabs, you know? And, like, he's made a load of shite recently as well for Netflix, which are clearly just fulfilling a contract, and this to me, this does nothing for me. This film, it's of all the Pacino films, including Gigli, it's probably the one I'd go to watch last if I was to watch them in the order of preference. It would probably be last on the list for me, because again, he's only got a bit part in it. Like, it's not like he's got a leading role in it. And Stand Up Guys, yeah, I think good cast, but a director that I think was probably a little bit unsure of himself in terms of what he wanted the film to be. And I do wonder if he made a mistake in casting two kind of titans in Al and Walken, who maybe pushed the film in different ways to be more what they wanted it to be. But again, it's not a bad film by any stretch. It's watchable. But likewise, I wouldn't be rushing to watch it again.
It's interesting to see how he follows that up, because after that spell of movies where I think, you know, anyone objectively would say he doesn't have a huge amount to do in some of them, and none of them jumped out at the audience as big bank successes. He follows it up with 2013 Salome, and he had played the role of Herod in Salome on the stage previously, and therefore again this is another one of his passion projects. I think he directs it too, and you know, it is an interesting concept. He has Jessica Chastain alongside him, and it is one which I have ordered on DVD or Blu-ray I think twice through Amazon within a job lot, and both times actually it was Amazon. Both times I've been let down. The amount of times that's happened to me with books and movies, I it's actually starting to get annoying. I think I must be a couple of hundred euros out at this stage through Jeff Bezos and his fucking magnificently shite company. But there we are. That's that. So I have not seen Salome, and obviously I didn't see the stage production. In 2014, there are two very interesting things that he does. The first one is a David Gordon Green film called Manglehorn. And what I really was, my curiosity was piqued by the fact that he stars alongside Holly Hunter, who's I'd watched doing anything, and Harmony Korine, who was a name when I was really interested in being part of film back in the 90s. He was the kind of enfant terrible of the acting, of the directing scene. He directed movies called Kids, Gummo, Julian Donkey Boy, all between 95 and 99. And I thought, okay, so now we're going to see Harmony Korine as an actor. And again, I could not wait to see Manglehorn. Haven't seen it. Can't get it. Can't see it. Can't buy it anywhere. That's that. That's my second in a row here. So I'm two for two here. And then 2014's The Humbling, another really interesting thing, because it's Barry Levinson, who's usually very, very good as a director. It's based on a Philip Roth novel. I think I've read everything by Philip Roth. It's got Al, it's got Diane Wiest, it's got Charles Grodin, who it was part of a movie we mentioned earlier on with Bob De Niro and Greta Gerwig, who people will know as the director of Barbie. And so I would like to tell you that at least I can offer you an opinion about one of those. But there's another one that is, I can't find it on streaming services. I don't have one of these dodgy box things that the world seems to have where you can access any movie anytime. So I only have access to whatever I have. Currently, I have Sky, I have Netflix, I have Prime on and off depending. I have Apple on and off depending. Can't find any of these. Can't find any of them. So I am completely at your mercy here in terms of whether you have an opinion on one or all three.
I didn't like Salom. It would be right down the bottom of my Al list. Now, the reason I didn't like it is because it's a bit weirdly done, because he made the docudrama Wild Salom, 2011 or something, and then he edited this film out of that docudrama. And made this, so like it feels a bit chopped together. It's not worth your while, really. Manglehorn, I didn't mind. I think it's okay. Like it's a decent Al performance. The Humbling is an interesting one. There was a lot of talk when it came out that it was Al playing like a fictionalized version of himself. But it's decent. Like it's a good performance from him. Not a great performance, but it's good. It's decent. But this is a kind of a slump that Al has hit here, without question. And like I said, Manglehorn's it's decent. The Humbling is decent, but the other one, Salome, it's definitely not one I'd rewatch. And it's one I'd actively turn off, to be honest.
So I'm going to take the next run, and we're going to pick out to the year 2019. We'll put that to one side. We'll finish on 2019. But I'm going to pick out the next few movies here. 2015 saw top lining Danny Collins, which, you know, is Dan Fogelman directorial debut. He's starring alongside a absolutely stellar cast of Jennifer Garner and Annette Bening and Bobby Cannavale and Chris Plummer. And then there's Misconduct in 2016. I think Anthony Hopkins is in there with him in that one. There's Hangman, which is more kind of standard crime thriller fare from him. Carl Urban's in it. He's tremendous. I enjoyed this. Joe Anderson, Sarah Shahi, Brittany Snow. I enjoyed this. It's by the numbers stuff. Pirates of Somalia in 2017 is a film drama by Brian Buckley. It's got him and Melanie Griffith. And again, I will have to plead the fifth on that one. Not seen it. 2021, there's a movie called American Traitor, The Trial of Axis Sally. And I don't know how big the Al Pacino role is in that one. House of Gucci from 2021 sees him take a very prominent role in an interesting film. With a very strong cast, as you might imagine. And I think that one took an awful lot of people's attention and got a lot of praise. And then in 2023, the most recent Al Pacino performance that you can go out and see in movies is Knox Goes Away, where you have Michael Keaton, who directs as well. And you've got a interesting cast, but the best two, the most well-known of the supporting cast, Keaton himself stars in it, are probably Marcia Gay Harden and James Marsden alongside Al. So of that bundle, just pick one that you want to talk about, because I do want us to have a minute or two to talk about the ones that everyone will have seen, which is Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and The Irishman.
So I'll just say that the Danny Collins, Misconduct, Hangman and Pirates of Somalia are all good films, and he's good in all of them. I haven't actually seen American Traitor. That's the one. Well, actually, I haven't seen Knox Goes Away either, to be fair. But it only came out last year. So I haven't seen that. American Traitor, I haven't seen at all. So I might have to go and find that over the next few days. But House of Gucci, I really, really liked. I think it's a very good film. It's a great cast. You've got Lady Gaga, who genuinely, I was shocked at how good she was in the lead role. Adam Driver is excellent. Jeremy Irons is excellent. Jared Leto is excellent. Salma Hayek is excellent. But Al is very, very good in this film.
Is that Jared Leto plucking his forehead there that I've seen, or with a ball cap? Is that him?
Yes, that's him. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. All right.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think it's a genuinely good film. I was surprised how much I enjoyed it. I was really surprised how good Lady Gaga was. She is tremendous in that film, and credit to her. But yeah, I think that's an excellent film that people should absolutely go and watch.
So if we were to dedicate a little bit of time to the two biggest movies of this period, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, that he features in, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, which is obviously a Tarantino joint and has this ridiculous cast of DiCaprio and Pitt and Margot Robbie and Emile Hirsch and all sorts of other people like Timothy Oliphant and Dakota Fanning and Bruce Dern and so on and so forth. It's Tarantino. People are queuing up. They want to be in a Tarantino film. I get the impression from what I've seen recently from documentaries and stuff over the last couple of years, they actually want to be shouted at by Tarantino, you know, in a kind of almost, masochistic way, because he's very intense. Tarantino, I saw a piece, he was doing an interview recently. It was actually kind of half talk, half interview, where he was talking to a crowd, it looked like students. And he was basically showing people how he directs. So he goes to one of the girls in the front row and he says, well, look, if I'm working with a director or with an actor, this is how I work. And he kneels about a yard in front of her and he says, this is me. I'm looking at you all the way through the scene. This is how we work. This is how I work. So I think a lot of people probably go out of their way to have that experience. I would be curious as to whether Al was sort of ticking a little box here as well, in terms of what he was going to do with this particular part, or why he wanted to be in this particular movie. You know, in a Tarantino movie, you're not surprised to see Kurt Russell pop up and people like that. It was a surprise for me to see the involvement of Al as Marvin Schwartz. So I look forward to hearing your take on that, even if you don't want to talk about the movie in general. And then the other big one that we have to mention is The Irishman. I mean, this was so widely anticipated. The fact that it's Martin Scorsese, who I think I am a Scorsese completist. I think I've seen everything several times that he's done, even the very early ones that are hard to get. I remember buying a couple of collections when I was a younger man. And obviously what really sold this was not just De Niro and Pacino, but De Niro, Pacino and Pesci altogether, and Keitel's in the freaking thing. And then you've got really surprising, excellent turn by Ray Romano. Who'd have thought it? Hawkins in it, Stephen Graham, who's really good. Stephen Graham can turn in a scene-chewing performance, or he can be low-key. He's an excellent actor, credit where it's due. And Bobby Cannavale, I think, probably took a few people by surprise with his work in this. I love that Martin Scorsese is still working with the same people after all these years. Actor-wise, absolutely. But he still has Robbie Robertson doing the music. He still has his editing done by Thelma Schoonmaker. This kind of thing I love. I love seeing these relationships over time in cinema. You go back and look at the confluence of what those three people have created over the years, never mind the actors, and it's very, very interesting and very impressive. So I'm anxious to hear what you think about this. Did you think this was a sort of tour de force Pacino performance? Because in many ways, I know it sort of favors the De Niro character in many ways in terms of probably screen time, but this is a huge, huge part to be playing the role of Jimmy Hoffa, for fuck's sake, the legendary, mythological almost creature that is Jimmy Hoffa, and where is he? It's a huge role, and he had a lot of freedom, I think, to interpret, but also tried his best to be faithful to whatever evidence there was of his character. The Sheeran thing, again, based on, inverted commas, a real character, but a lot of room for Bobby De Niro to sort of put his own Bobby De Niro stamp on it, which he does. So the question I have for you, having watched him in The Irishman, you can mention De Niro too if you like here. Did you just feel you were watching Al Pacino, or did you feel you were watching something else? This is what I'm wondering. Is this the upshot of what this show has been about so far, the movies of this period? Is it just different shades of Al doing Al, the movie star? Or did you think that there are individual roles? I would say the thing that gives the lie to that so far in the films that we've spoken about today is 2004's Merchant of Venice. I think that's just that you take that, you put that to one side. It doesn't belong in any category. It's not crumpled suit, supporting role, or co-top billing Al. It's a different version. It's a different beast. It's him really immersed in the part. Did either of these two, comparatively high profile, one more a cameo and one very much a leading role, sort of break that mold of what we've seen established here with these sort of slightly forgettable movies of this period?
I think The Irishman is like it. Jack Nicholson did the kind of ultimate Hoffa display in Hoffa. And I think that's a lot of people's reference point, especially people of sort of your generation of mine, that, you know, Jimmy Hoffa, who, like, we didn't know who he was when he was alive. Well, I wasn't born. You were only a young child. So we didn't know who he was. So his legend sort of came upon us afterwards. So Jack Nicholson making that film in 82, or sorry, 92, with Danny DeVito, which I think is a good film. Danny DeVito directs it. I really enjoyed it. That's always sort of been my reference point.
Yes.
For Jimmy Hoffa.
Yeah.
And I suppose when I went into watching The Irishman, and I should say, I looked at the runtime of 2 hours and 9 minutes and thought, there's absolutely no way I'm going to watch that in one sitting. So what I did was I watched it in 4 sittings. I watched it over 4 different nights. About 50 minutes ago.
It's 3 hours and 9 minutes, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's 3 hours and 29 minutes.
3 hours and 20. Right. Yeah.
It's a monstrous film. And so I was like, there's no way I'm watching the whole thing in one go. I don't have the attention span, and I'm going to get bored if I watch it that way. And I think it was Eddie had said to me that he'd kind of watched it over a couple of nights. So I almost made a mini series of it.
Yeah,
and I kind of waited till there was a lull, and I was like, right, I'll cut it off there, and then I can start back tomorrow almost like a new episode. And I actually think had they released it as a mini series, I think people would have adored it. I think because it was released as a film and it's so long, I think it drained a lot of people, because I do think there's really good performances in this. Like, I do think Al is very good in this. I do think De Niro's very good as Frank Sheehan. I love Joe Pesci, maybe as much as I love Al. I just, Joe Pesci for me, when he retired, it was a sad day. When he came back, it was a joyous thing. I just think he's incredibly good. And like, when you look back at Joe Pesci's filmography, and even the films in which he has the supporting role, he is the ultimate show stealer for me.
What's great about it too is it does embrace the history and politics of the era. I'm kind of obsessed with this period of history in general, and obviously you have to go to America, and the fact the Kennedys in particular are a source of massive interest to me, and you know the clash between Bobby Kennedy and the mafia is quite famous, the stuff of lore. I love, you know, Nixon references and all that kind of stuff. There's the Teamsters stuff, which is obviously where Hoffa is the big dog on campus. And the interaction between all of those sort of entities is has always been of interest to me. And I agree with you, actually. I think I judged it overly harshly. I did watch it twice. I did watch it through twice, because that's the kind of sadist I am. But whereas it wasn't really necessarily the idea of my falling away or lacking engagement with it, that wasn't really it. There were just a couple of things that jarred with me over the course of it. One or two of them were technical things. I think I spoke about it recently, the de-aging thing. I found it distracting. I think casting a younger man would have been a much better bet. And then you just see De Niro in the roles that he can actually play. You see Al in the roles that he can actually play. This is what I'd rather see. Pesci as well. I'd rather have seen that. And don't tell me that's not possible. Of course.
No, of course it is. Like, we often see in films, you'll see an actor play a role played by like three different people across three different eras of that person's life. And you nailed it when you said, yeah, they can make the face look a bit younger, but the body still moves like an old man.
Yeah.
And when De Niro with the de-aging is kicking the tar out of somebody, he's kicking them as an elfla.
That's it. It's an 80-year-old curb stomping someone. And as an 80-year-old, you do that in stages.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? There's nothing fluid about it. It's definitely not an aggressive move. And it just, it jars. I watched it and I thought, okay, I just mentioned Thelma Schoonmaker. I mentioned Martin Scorsese. How do these two geniuses of their craft look back through that and go, yeah, that looks good. Yeah, let's go with that.
Yeah. Like, even if they just shot it from slightly different angles where they could have used body doubles for some of those kind of scenes where there was more sort of explosive aggression needed.
Yeah.
That would have worked. Like, you know, it's not like De Niro has a unique body or something. Somebody else could have played him from the back. I love Scorsese. And what I love about him is what you mentioned. It's the fact that he makes films with his friends. He's got his actors that he goes to. He's got his editor that he uses. He's got his music person that he uses. He's got this guy and that woman, and they're the people that he is going to use, and to hell with the rest of it. And if someone wants him to do something different, he's just not going to do it. Scorsese at this point, I think, is making films for himself. Films that he would like to see with the people he would like to see in them. And I'm here for it. And I will watch them until the day he no longer makes films.
Do you think he probably just wouldn't? Because I'm really, really interested in this concept you were talking about making it a three-part or four-part miniseries and how that would have actually really probably just been an absolute sensation. I mean, the fact is, it was a Netflix thing and it was released on Netflix. So why not go the whole hog? Do you think it was a Scorsese thing of like, I'm not doing TV?
I genuinely think it was.
Yeah.
I think it was just the thing of, like, no, I've decided how I'm doing it, and this is what I'm doing.
Yeah.
So, you know, I've done the TV thing. I did vinyl. You know, you made me work with Mick Jagger. I've done that. I did the early episode of Boardwalk Empire. I was involved in that. I've done my stint in TV, and now I'm making films for me.
Yeah.
But, like, I enjoyed it. The way I watched it, I think was worked for me. And again, it's not for everybody. Others will happily sit and watch through because they've got a better attention span than I have. But, I love that you mentioned Stephen Graham as well, because I think he's an excellent actor. And I recently rewatched Little Boy Blue, the miniseries, which is, it's a tough watch, but he's absolutely incredible in it.
Yeah, agreed.
So I would highly recommend that. Like, in This Is England, he's incredible. I'll watch Stephen Graham in anything. I think he's genuinely a great, great actor. But again, the cast here, like Jesse Plemons, who's really, really good. Stephen Van Zandt, who I love for two reasons. Number one, he's obviously in the E Street Band, who I grew up on the E Street Band. My mom might be the biggest Bruce Springsteen fan in the world.
Right.
And number two, obviously, he was just phenomenal in The Sopranos. So I just love him and love him as an individual as well. But like top to bottom, like Ray Romano, like you said, who saw that coming?
I mean, seriously. And he's brilliant.
He's brilliant. And you wonder, like, did Ray Romano miss his calling
as
an actor?
Yeah.
Did he waste too long doing... Now, he made great comedy. Like, Everybody Loves Raymond is an all-timer comedy. But you'd wonder, like, should he have been doing different stuff? Because, like, he's brilliant here. And I think
of Everybody Loves Raymond, and I think of Peter Boyle. And then I even think of the guy, I can't think of his name off my the top of my head, who plays his brother. I even think of his missus before.
Oh, Brad Garrett, yeah.
Yeah, I think of all of these characters. Like, he's sort of absolutely the core of the show, and yet but then you see him do this and you go, yeah, I think you're right. I think that's a really good point. There's a whole different Ray Romano career elsewhere where he's not just like doing funny voiceovers in Disney Pixar movies, you know what I mean?
That's the thing. Like, he might have been, because, like, you know, for people always said, like, Brando passed the torch to Pacino and De Niro as that sort of, you know, that the kind of the guy that's going to carry that kind of Italian sort of bloodline through as, like, you know, the leading man, the guy that can do the mafia role, can do the cop role, can do this, can do that. And then there was sort of, well, there's nobody now for Pacino and De Niro to pass it on to. Kind of DiCaprio, but he's not from the same sort of background and lineage. He's not got that sort of New York toughness to him. This guy could have been the guy, without question. Like, I think he's done a few other roles where he's a bit, you know, it's a bit more of a serious role. But, like, he did just spend so long doing the comedy stuff. And obviously, like you said, doing a lot of the voiceover work with the Ice Age franchise and stuff. But he is, without question, a very, very good actor. And there's a TV show he did called Made for Love, which is pretty decent. And it was kind of a move away from the kind of comedies and the comedy dramas that he'd sort of made his name on. But this is excellent. He is probably, of all the performances, his is probably the standout.
And before we go into the last sort of chunk of this, because this is going, the last chunk is going to be basically you telling me about what I need to watch on television. But just a word for the cameo in the Tarantino thing, of note, not of note, incidental, worth a mention. What did you think?
No, definitely worth a mention. Definitely worth a mention. Like, it's Tarantino. So, like, I think this might have been a bit of a box-ticking moment for both of them.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Tarantino's made a number of films over the years where you could picture Al in them. And for Al, the chance to work with probably the only great director of the last 30 years that he hadn't worked with previously, or that he might class as a great director.
Yeah.
So I think for both of them, this was a great opportunity to tick a box. And like you said, Al might have wanted to get that experience of working with Tarantino and his methods and just see what that could do for him. But, like, in fairness, Tarantino likely had enough respect to not go over and scream at Al Pacino the way he might at somebody else. Yeah. But again, like, this is a good film. Like, it's obviously got a kind of comedic tone to it as well. On what is an incredibly serious topic. But yeah, I enjoyed it, and it's a story, an incident in history that I'm fascinated by, the Manson family and the absolute lunacy surrounding Charles Manson and everything that he did and everything that he was able to convince other people to do on his behalf. And I do often think, you know, when you think of where Sharon Tate was at the time and obviously who she was married to, and you think of those other people that were there, what if something like that happened now? What would the public reaction be to it? With the way we have the internet now and everything's minute by minute updates, like, I do often think, like, what would be the reaction if something like that happened now? But no, I think it's a good film. I think it sits well for Tarantino in terms of his filmography. I'd like to see him work a bit more often. Didn't feel we needed the 4-year gap after The Hateful Eight, which I'd imagine was a pretty quick one to turn around. And I'm curious as to why we've been waiting 5 years for him to do something else. So a bit more elbow grease into the career, Quentin, and we'd all be grateful. it's good. Like it is a good film, and it's really well made, which is what you expect from Quentin Tarantino.
I enjoyed it. Like I've enjoyed a lot of Tarantino movies of late. I felt with Scorsese, just this is my personal take, so you know it's whatever. I felt there was a sort of diminishing returns thing that happened from a certain point on with Scorsese's career. That you could still see quality, but like I say, just diminishing returns. I mean, I still have Mean Streets in my top 3 to 5 movies of all time because for me it was so meaningful and poignant, and never a better example of a lad getting as many people around him as he can and turning something wonderful out of it. But I have that feeling a little bit as well with Tarantino. And again, that's unpopular because some people are just, you know, incredible devotees and they don't want to hear anything negative at all. Like they didn't want to hear anything negative about The Irishman. But for me, it's more about like picking out these little set pieces from both men's movies of recent years. And there are several that are just outstanding and memorable and therefore makes the things worthwhile. There is a whole period, a whole chunk.
Do you wonder with Tarantino, though, like, he's obviously made tremendous films, but do you wonder, does he look at, like, Jackie Brown, the Kill Bill movies, Death Proof, Inglourious Basterds, which is excellent, Django Unchained, which is excellent, The Hateful Eight and this, and do you wonder, like, does he look at it and go, if I just walked away after Pulp Fiction, and all I'd done was Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction, like, do you think would people just... Obviously, people are in awe of him anyway, but, like, it was always going to be really tough for him to match, let alone top, those first two movies.
I'd say include Jackie Brown in there and then walk.
Do you know?
Because I think Jackie Brown's this kind of... I think that's excellent. I think it's an amazing movie, and the more you go back to it, the better it gets. It's one of those, and I think then it's this sort of, I'm not going to say style over substance because that would be completely wrong, but it is these movies that some people absolutely worship and adore, and some people find it hard because there are different things in them that jar with them. I understand the point you're making completely, and it's, you know, like, again, this is not to insult anybody else's taste. It's just purely my own personal thing. I just thought there's a point in both men's careers where it's just sort of just feels a little bit diminishing returns in terms of the greatness of it. And for me, I don't know. This is controversial and annoys the shit out of a lot of people, but I don't have the same reverence for Leo DiCaprio as someone you hang your hat on, as a lot of people do. I just don't see it. I don't get it. I never have. I've always tried. Yes, he's brilliant in certain films that are actually brilliant themselves.
That's the thing. Like, if he gets a great film to work with, I think he can give you a great performance.
Yeah.
But likewise, if the film is questionable, I often find that he can be questionable. Like with Tarantino, I agree with you. I think there is style over substance. I think if we look at Reservoir Dogs, Pulp Fiction, Inglourious Basterds, and Django Unchained, I think the first two are incredible.
You're not having Jackie Brown.
Oh, sorry, Jackie Brown. Sorry, So that's five, right? I would take those five movies and I'd put them five up against anybody else's body of work.
Yeah, agreed.
And then I would say you look at the others. And like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood it's good. Like it is a good film. But I think the Kill Bill movies are enormously overrated. I think Death Proof is average, to be fair.
Well, it's him being influenced by genre stuff and the ridiculous depth of knowledge that he has and trying to get that across. And some people love all that, you know, like Death Proof is a perfect example. Some people love all that. And some people think, like me, I just want the whole package to be something that I find sort of really powerful overall.
That's the thing. And like the Hateful Eight is, again, it's decent, like, but it's not life changing.
No,
whereas the first time you saw Reservoir Dogs or Pulp Fiction or Jackie Brown,
you just want to watch them again.
You're just like, wow. You want to watch them again immediately.
Immediately. Let's watch that
again. You know, like, Reservoir Dogs for me is still his best movie, in my opinion. Others will say Pulp Fiction. Others will say Jackie Brown. Others will say Django. Others will say The Hateful Eight, or the Inglourious Basterds. But for me, like, there is filler in his filmography. There's no bad movie. I'll give him that. He hasn't made anything bad. He hasn't made anything that I wouldn't rewatch. But there's a top three. Then there's a next tier of two, and then there's that next group, and you're like, yeah, but no, like, good, but overrated because of him, and he's not in the films. Do you know what I mean?
I'm just glad you said that, because that's how I've always felt about it, and it's a totally different arc from Scorsese, where it's just the magical luster just disappeared slowly, whereas with that guy it's different. They just feel, and I understand, it's not like we're not talking out of our arses here and not understanding that he's very heavily influenced in Kill Bill and in Death Proof or in Hateful Eight by kind of genre pieces and trying to emulate certain aspects of them. I get it, right? Yeah, but it needs to hang together as a whole and have you want to watch it again. I didn't feel that with any of those.
And you're right with Scorsese, because you look at Scorsese's work, Who's That Knocking at My Door, Boxcar Bertha, Mean Streets, Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, Taxi Driver, New York, New York, Raging Bull, The King of Comedy, After Hours, The Color of Money, The Last Temptation of Christ, Goodfellas, Cape Fear, The Age of Innocence, and Casino. That is an unbelievable run. There's one or two that don't stand up to the level of the rest of them, obviously, but it's an unbelievable run. But then, I mean, Kundun, meh. Bringing Out the Dead, it's okay. You know, it's a decent performance from Nick Cage. Gangs of New York is very good. The Aviator left me a bit cold afterwards.
Same. And that's
the Departed, I think, is good, but I think it's overrated.
It's not a great film. Some people love that movie. They absolutely love it. I don't see it.
The cast is unreal. So I think that's what drew a lot of people to it, but I think it's overrated. Shutter Island, the book is phenomenal. The Dennis Lehane book, and Dennis Lehane is one of my favorite authors. The book is phenomenal. The film, I think, is just okay. I did enjoy Hugo because it was something different from him. I thought The Wolf of Wall Street was a bit of a hot mess, to be totally honest with you. Wasn't overly impressed by Silence at all. And The Irishman, in the format I watched it, I really enjoyed it. But again, as a film, there's probably an hour that they could have just lobbed off it, because there's a lot of, like you were saying earlier, there's just those, it hits those runs and those ruts in the film. You're like, why is this here? Like, why do we need this much of this? This could have been a 1 minute scene, and instead it's an 8 minute scene. And I haven't seen Killers of the Moonflower, but like I said earlier, Martin is making films for Martin. And I'm fully on board with it, because I think that run from 72 to 95, I think that has earned him the right to do whatever the fuck he wants.
Listen, the year I was born, he makes Mean Streets. And that's, like I say, that's going to be in my top five forever. I know it off by heart. It's a movie that made me fall in love with cinema. It's got some just, it's fucking amazing. It's just beautiful to look at. Incredible performances. It's why I love cinema, that film right there. That's what made me think Scorsese's a genius. But then 3 years later, he does Taxi Driver. New York, New York is what it is. For a lot of people, it's like an all-time classic. I haven't warmed to it like that, but I love it. And when you see it now in comparison to some modern cinema, you go, my Jesus, so good. But like Taxi Driver, Raging Bull, King of Comedy, those are absolutely outrageously wonderful films. And that's a guy working with another guy and making incredible art. Each one of those has a case for being, you know, an all-time great for different reasons. And then, like you say, it's After Hours and The Color of Money and The Last Temptation, all those. I love them all. And you can see Scorsese all the way through all of them. They're very visually indicative of him as a director. But it's then Goodfellas, Cape Fear, those two back to back. You feel like, oh, he's in kind of more comfortable territory. Love this. Love watching a Scorsese movie. Age of Innocence is one that gets not enough love. I think it's brilliant, and Day-Lewis is great in it, and Winona Ryder's great in it. Casino then, and like you say, that's where. But yeah, from Kundun, Bringing Out the Dead, I remember being incredibly, I was so underwhelmed by Bringing Out the Dead. Kundun, I was trying to say, okay, well, I see what he's trying to do here. It's okay, right, whatever. It's an interesting piece in a bigger thing, and then he backed that up with Bringing Out the Dead, and I was like, oh, Nick Cage and Ving Rhames, and I was going, this doesn't seem right. The Aviator, I was so underwhelmed as well. I like The Departed, I like Shutter Island, I like The Wolf of Wall Street, but none of them are magical, great, all-time films for me. And Gangs is right in there as well, which again is tremendously entertaining, but is not the sum of its parts, if you understand what I mean.
Yeah, that's fair.
And so I'm now looking at doing an Apple TV subscription to go and watch Killers of the Flower Moon, and I already know that certain aspects of it I'm going to love and certain aspects of it I'm not going to love. I kind of know too much about it in advance, which is annoying. I've seen too many clips of it in advance, which is annoying, but I'm going to have to go and do it. I'll be getting that Apple TV subscription because of Martin Scorsese, and the back of it, I'll be able to watch a couple of Al Pacino things. And to finish our show, there was a big sort of television aspect to the Al Pacino career. And I just want to finish with the last 12, 14, 15 minutes, whatever we do here, on that, because it's, like I said, it's going to be you kind of educating me on it more than anything else. 2003's Angels in America was as far as I don't know whether Al was only in six episodes or it was a six episode miniseries. It's Mike Nichols, and it's got at its heart this high concept notion of a guy who's living with AIDS, visited by an angel. Now, according to the blurb, we get sort of a nice insight into the whole Reagan era, the politics of the time, the tensions around AIDS and what it was and how people related to it in society, the presentation of it in the media and so on and so forth. That's a tremendously interesting rabbit hole that we won't go down. Let's talk purely about Al in this and what you know of it and what you can tell us about him in it.
He is brilliant in it. Al, this is great Al. Like, genuinely great Al Pacino. It's a really interesting concept. It's based off a play by Tony Kushner. I think originally the plan was to make it a film. Then they realized that the film was going to be about 6 hours long. So they were like, well, it can't go out as a 6-hour film because nobody's going to watch that. So initially it was broadcast as a three-part mini-series, 2 hours per go, and then it got re-edited into a six-part mini-series an hour ago. It's very, very good. It is genuinely very, very good.
Can I just ask you something? Because anybody who knows anything about the recent political era will have heard an awful lot about Roy Cohn. And Roy Cohn started off as the lawyer to Joe McCarthy of the McCarthy era. Famously, a terrible set of lads. And Roy Cohn, his reputation as a sort of a hard right, tough, sort of get jobs done that are deeply, deeply unpleasant type of fixer guy is very, very interesting. And I can't imagine Pacino doing it. This is why I'm so fascinated by it. Does he humanize the role, or is he kind of a bad guy in it, or how does he come off?
He does humanize it a bit. He does humanize it a bit, but it's one of them where he's hard to like, but you take pity on him because he's dying of AIDS, you know? And yeah, I mean, Roy Cohn, not as terrible a set of lads, obviously, as Joseph McCarthy, who, you know, if we were listing the all-time terrible set of lads, 11, he's probably got a case for a spot on the bench, if not a starting role. Do you know they say that hate ages you? Just take a look at the picture of Joe McCarthy on his Wikipedia page and bear in mind that he is 46 years of age when that picture is taken.
It's mad. It's absolutely mad.
He looks like your granddad. That's what he looks like.
It's mad. Right, that's interesting. Okay, so that's that. That's Angels in America. I am now completely, entirely all in. I had no notions about it. I deliberately didn't want to know anything about it. Didn't look it up.
Meryl Streep is also incredible in it, by the way.
I could not be more intrigued. I could not be more intrigued. But we need to keep going because we don't want this to go on all night. And we have a couple more to get through that I know you want to talk about as well. Mm. So that's 03. 2010 is his portrayal of Jack Kevorkian in You Don't Know Jack. Then 2013, he plays Phil Spector in another TV film role. And it looks very much like Helen Mirren is alongside him there, judging by the poster. And Phil Spector's a very interesting fella. He also plays Joe Paterno in a HBO show about a guy who's a former Penn State football coach and was involved in a very, very unpleasant child sex scandal. And then there's Hunters, where he plays Meyer Offerman, and it's 18 episodes. And again, I think this is one of the ones that's on Amazon Prime, where just as I was about to get into that, my latest temporary membership ran out. So I never got to that one either. So I want you to pick out, because we don't have time to go through them all, I want you to pick out a couple of them, but will you just give me a little bit of a mention for the Jack Kevorkian one? Because I know the story of Jack Kevorkian. And I find that a fascinating story. And I know the story generally behind the idea of Hunters, which I think will fascinate an awful lot of people as well. So of those, what do you want to pick out? Just start with that You Don't Know Jack one, because I think that earned them quite a few awards as well, if I recall.
It did. And it's a really, really good TV movie. One of the excellent HBO feature films that they did. Jack Kevorkian, for people that don't know, was a euthanasia proponent who was found to be helping the terminally ill and the severely disabled end their lives in a discreet and, you know, in a good way, in a painless way. Similar to what we see now being legalized in certain places. Switzerland has long been a place where people would go. Terry Pratchett, very famously. Jack Kevorkian was in favor of this, in not having people suffer. And yet, because of the way America chooses to be, he was basically portrayed as kind of what Harold Shipman was, which was a mass murderer. But that's
Dr.
not
Death, they call
Dr.
him, didn't
Death,
they?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's not what he was doing at all. It was just that, you know, the American media are run by a bunch of puppets who are bought and paid for by the health industry, the drug industry, et cetera, et cetera. And what Kevorkian did was dip into their pockets by not having people shell out hundreds of thousands of dollars to prolong their own suffering. Instead, he helped them, you know, find the right end, I suppose. Al is excellent in this. Then we go next to Phil Spector. Again, it's it's a good performance from Al. It's well worth your while watching it. If you don't know the Phil Spector story, I do highly recommend giving that one a watch. Helen Mirren is excellent in that as well. I'll skip Paterno and come back to it, but Hunters is very good. And I was disappointed when they decided to only do the two seasons of it, because I think it had scope for more. But it's a fascinating story, and it's based on, you know, it's inspired by real events, the Nazi hunters, you know, in New York and in different places over the last couple of decades, digging out the Nazis who'd escaped Germany, taken on new identities, and, you know, were peacefully going about their days despite the atrocities that they'd been part of. So it's very good, and he's very, very good in it. Paterno was one that I was very interested in seeing because I love American sports and I watch a lot of college football. I don't fully understand American football. Like, there's certain rules and stuff that still baffle me, and I've been watching it for years and years. And I think at this point I'm too proud or too ignorant to ask people to explain them to me. But I find college football fascinating because these are 18 to 22 year old individuals playing games on a Saturday in front of 100,000 people. And Joe Paterno was coach of the Penn State Nittany Lions for 40 years, I think, might have been longer. 55 years he was head coach of the Penn State Nittany Lions. And the Nittany Lions play at Beaver Stadium, which holds 106,000. So it's more the crowd, the atmosphere, the whole thing that really draws me in. So I'd watched a lot of their games. You came to really like him because he was like your granddad. And he was this, you know, doddery old man, but still a very sharp mind. And you'd see him on the sideline and he's a small little hunched over old man surrounded by these enormous human beings. So I was always interested in Joe Paterno because I also fascinated by great coaches, great managers, team building, you know, long-term success is something that has always interested me. So that's what drew me to him. So in 2011, a story broke that Jerry Sandusky, who was the assistant coach to Paterno and had been for a long time, had been molesting players. Now, he was long since gone from Penn State. He'd been dismissed about a decade earlier for different reasons, allegedly. And this story breaks that he had, over multiple decades, molested hundreds, if not thousands, of young boys and young men, both at Penn State and elsewhere. And that Paterno had some knowledge of it. How much he had is questioned. Nobody is fully sure. Some say he didn't know very much. Some say he knew a lot. And basically, he gets fired. He gets fired as the head coach after 55 years. His statue is taken down. His legacy is massively tarnished. And then he dies of lung cancer about 3 months later. And I don't think anybody knew at the time he was fired that he had lung cancer, that he was fighting this battle. And the film is just a really good look into him and his, you know, late days as coach. Al is excellent. Again, this kind of format seems to really suit him, playing a real person and having that source material to work from, being able to go and study their mannerisms, their speech, you know, the speech patterns, etc., etc. This is really, really good. So, yeah, I would recommend watching all of his TV stuff. Angels in America. It's a tough, like, it can be a tough watch. It's maybe not one you'll sit and binge. But you don't know Jack, Phil Spector, and Paterno, all very, very good, strong performances. Not all-time performances, but very strong. And Hunters is excellent. Now, he's one of a cast in this. And he's spoken glowingly about his experience doing it, how, you know, he'd always turned down TV stuff before. He did Angels in America because it was a mini series, a project this was the first time he committed to doing a TV series, mm. and he wasn't fully sure what it was going to be, but he was really excited, and he really enjoyed the whole experience of, you know, making a TV series. So it wouldn't surprise me if he does something like it, if he does another TV show, because he said for years he turned them down because, well, I'm a movie star, I'm not a TV actor. But he said this really opened his eyes to this could be something that I could really enjoy, and is maybe a bit easier schedule-wise, considering his age.
Yeah, well, I mean, if he's not busy adding to his current record of being one of the oldest fathers on the books, mm. perhaps he will grace us with more stuff. I'm hoping that'll be the case. I'm hoping there's a couple of, you know, properly ancient Al touching movie performances. I think he still has it in him. I'd love to see that. I'd love to see some more TV work. I look forward to actually filling in the blanks that I've discovered I have over the course of doing this show with you. And I think, listen, it would be hard to argue that we haven't done justice to the lad in terms of doing three shows now, all of them about 90 odd minutes on the career of Al Pacino. And it's great, I think, because he is a guy who's so important to both of us. I think we both said he's kind of top of the totem pole or thereabouts for the two of us. And so it just felt absolutely right. And it's just really interesting that in each of these shows, I know, and I know you have as well, have sort of kept having to tamp down all these incredible sort of by roads I want to wander down.
Oh, yeah.
All it says to me is that we have nothing but potential for buzz in the days and weeks and months and years, hopefully, to come with this show. We've enjoyed very much doing Al Pacino parts 1, 2, and now 3 with you. But from myself and from Dave, we'll wrap this one up and we'll speak to you soon, because next up, it is more Al in the absolutely marvelous Glengarry Glen Ross. Speak to you soon.
Sports Social Podcast Network.